And welcome to the latest edition of the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matthew Broomfield. As listeners will know, on this show we speak with mostly international friends, supporters, colleagues and comrades of the Kurdish movement to get a deeper understanding of the Kurdish political movement and of the situation in Kurdistan, and particularly how that relates to the rest of the world politically, diplomatically, culturally and otherwise. Today, we speak about one of the great links of the Kurdish movement to the outside world, which is its political leader, its spiritual figurehead, and its intellectual driving force, Abdullah Öcalan. As listeners will doubtless be aware, it's now been over 20 years, 23 years, that Öcalan has been detained by the Turkish state on the island of İmralı. We'll get some new updates about that in a moment. But throughout this time, he has nonetheless managed to communicate his ideas, not only throughout Kurdistan, but also to disseminate them to the rest of the world. My guest today is someone who works very much both on the side of raising awareness about the appalling treatment of Mr. Öcalan as a rights issue and as a political issue and as an issue of the miscarriage of justice, but also works on disseminating these ideas throughout the world. So yeah, we're very happy to speak with you today, Haveen. Maybe you could just introduce yourself and your organization and what you do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Matt and Media News. Yes, the International Initiative Freedom for Abdullah Öcalan, Peace in Kurdistan, was founded in the midst of Öcalan's abduction, like a piracy act from Nairobi, Kenya in 1999. And as a result, the outrage that many felt around the world towards this piracy act led them to found the International Initiative. At the beginning, the initiative was working mostly about the lifting of the death penalty in Turkey, which was still in law. But later it evolved into doing many other things, like you have mentioned, both to draw attention to the lawlessness or the extra legal conditions of Abdullah Öcalan and how he's being kept in an island prison and the conditions under which this happened, but as well as to organize freedom campaigns. And also, of course, to translate his works and to discuss his works in the light of the developments around the world, but also especially in Kurdistan and in the Middle East. So, and I have been part of this, I'm honored to be part of this this work for a long, long time now. So and very happy to be with you today, Matt.
Thank you. Maybe we could begin actually by speaking about some of those works. I know that you've obviously been involved in reading them, writing them, translating them, spreading them. Do you see in Öcalan's writing the impact of these 23 years that he has spent in prison? How does that isolation affect his writing and his philosophy?
Mm-hmm. I think perhaps first we need to start by saying that, in fact, tomorrow is the 9th of October, yes, which Kurds everywhere around the world protest against, which was the beginning of an ordeal which led to this abduction that I mentioned in Nairobi, Kenya. So in 1998, 24 years ago, Öcalan was forced out of Syria with the help of US, Britain, and Israel. And as you may remember, with Turkey deploying its army at the Syrian border, threatening to attack Syria. So ever since then, much has happened, not only in Kurdistan, but in Turkey and Middle East at large and the whole world. If you remember after that, in September 11, Twin Towers attack occurred in the US. Then there was invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq, and the list goes on and on. And obviously, the Kurdish leader, Abdullah Öcalan, was little known to the whole world when all this happened. And with his abduction in Kenya, and with the strong reaction of the Kurds all around the world, one could say that it was a first step towards the world getting to know this struggle and the resilience of the Kurdish people and Abdullah Öcalan also in general. Öcalan has been warning the development of a third world war for more than 10 years now. For those of you who have read his works, which I will maybe explain later, that they are not actually books, because thinking that they are books may lead us astray about his conditions on the Imrala Island prison. They are actually defenses to various courts, and especially to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. So Öcalan has been warning about this Third World War, and we are seeing that this has, you know, become more visible to everybody, especially in the last couple of years after the, you know, the storm blew off after the COVID. And we are seeing that more and more, you know, NATO is gearing up to this, not defensive, but an offensive position all around the world. And there's a huge full-scale war going in the Middle East, especially in the Kurdish heartland, homeland, whether it's in Turkey, in Iraq, in Syria, and now more so in Iran and in Rashilat. So without putting it into all of this context, and without putting into context what happened actually between 9th of October 1998 and today, but more so to the point of abduction from Nairobi, perhaps we cannot understand, you know, what Abdullah Öcalan has been through and what his mindset, how his mindset has developed in order to understand what is going on. I always find it very, very emotional and highly important what he states in one of his defenses, which is to the Court of Athens. You know, there he says that he had to scrap all notion of individual and personal feelings and honor, you know, during his abduction and the way he was taken to the Imrala Island prison and to Turkey. And he had to figure out a way of responding to this, what the Kurdish people call the international plot, because both the Kurds and Öcalan were very much aware of how the history wanted to be repeated. And that, you know, they talk about 29 rebellions of Kurds, and, you know, each of them historically has been suppressed with massacres and genocide, with the capture of their leader, and then a full-scale repression of the Kurdish society and their movement. So Öcalan was very, very much aware of all of this.
Yeah, and his first-hand experience of the way that states operate in the modern world. It wasn't just something in the abstract. It's something that he lived and lives.
Exactly. Exactly. And he mentions in his writings from prison that, you know, he went actually to Europe, and he talked about it before his abduction, to try and find a political solution within the framework of laws and democratic politics within Europe. And he saw very, very quickly that all of this was a huge farce. And maybe also he saw very much firsthand that the Kurdish question was actually the product of capitalist modernity's intervention in the Middle East and redesigning of states on the basis of a dominant nation. And therefore, you know, experiencing this firsthand, seeing that none of the laws that should have applied to him did not apply. And no matter what the Kurdish people did, it did not stop this NATO operation, which was led by the US, but also there were other players like Israel, and especially the role of UK in this sense was also very important. And he saw then that there must be another way out, that, you know, and I think what he did as a result, you know, as a result of this huge responsibility he felt for his people, for the Kurdish people, and the people in the Middle East, because he saw that, you know, this movement wanted to be hijacked, so that, you know, as we see all around the world, movements can be hijacked by different powers in order to serve their own interests, to redesign systems, regimes, not for the well and the goodness of the people, but to serve their own interests. So therefore, you know, he came up with a solution so that this history would not repeat itself. And he continued the threads that already were there before 99, you know, because sometimes the way that some would like to show it is that, okay, Öcalan was abducted, and bang, after 99, all these things, you know, about the state, about women's freedom, suddenly fell out of the sky. Well, this is not the case. But I think what the conditions actually did to him was to see the reality and the truth more starkly, and not to waste time in the traps that every other movement falls into, but to relook at history with that intent, to connect, you know, the past, the present, in order to be able to offer, to overcome, you know, the contradictions and the problems that all of humanity are experiencing, including
maybe if we move now on that note, for kind of from this long, very long imprisonment to the present day, or into future even, what then is the role and the continued importance of Öcalan today, kind of beyond the question of his personal rights that are being infringed? Why is there internationally a need for his freedom? What would change as a result of that?
Okay, but let me first of all point out, because him as a person and what he's been subjected to is also highly important. And let me also point out that, you know, he and we know less and less about his conditions, you know. Öcalan never actually emphasized what he really experiences in the Imralı Island prison, because he did not find it very moral that these kind of things should be used as a bargaining stick by the Turkish state. So he was always very careful about this. But we should not, you know, we should be very stern with this and describe it as a torture regime indeed, you know. Each and every approach taken against Öcalan and the other prisoners on the island is highly calculated, you know, with the intended result. He is watched 24 hours a day through cameras, you know, and he's also watched through a loophole on the door to his cell. And we know that even that is used to torture him. Sometimes shot very loudly, you know, he's watched through that loophole throughout the day. We knew in the early years that there was a light on for 24 hours a day. So we are not sure whether this is still the case, but we have every, you know, right to feel that this is still the case. Food was also made an issue. He was brought half-eaten marmalades, jams, you know, for breakfast. There was an attempted poisoning of him in 2007. There was cell confinement penalties, you know, even when he was the sole inmate on the island. And his pen and paper, all his books were taken away, and he was made to look at, stare at white walls. He had only one radio channel, which was the state's radio channel. This was also taken away from him most of the time. And only in January 2013, I think it was, that he was given a TV as a result of Talks for Talks that collapsed in 2015. So we must see how his treatment echoes as treatment to the Kurds at large, you know, whether it's in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, but especially Syria, and also even in Europe. Because what we are seeing is that law, European law, is not being implemented positively to the Kurds, you know. It's been continuously used to criminalize the Kurds, and obviously, most of all, Öcalan, and to make all of this seem okay. So we are seeing that although there could be progressive elements in the European Convention of Human Rights, but in the case of the Kurds, whether it's the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg or the CPT, what we are seeing is a lack of implementation when it comes to, for Kurds and Öcalan to make positive use of these laws. But these laws, when coupled with Turkey's terrorization campaign and oppression and genocidal campaign against the Kurds and Öcalan, these laws are brought up against the Kurds. And as I said, used so that their struggle doesn't see the day of light, they hope.
So do you believe that there can be any legal routes to a solution in this case? Or will a kind of a change in the conditions of Öcalan require then a political solution for the whole Kurdish question? Is it possible that he will be one day freed through legal appeal, or is this possibility vanished?
Yes, well, I think, you know, what we can see is that from what I've just been saying, that, you know, laws both in Turkey and the Kurdish question being the consequence of this one nation, one flag, one language, you know, one religion, nation states, and especially a very strict interpretation and a very fascist interpretation by the Turkish state, and its endorsement, whether it's because of interests or in trying to, you know, use the Kurds and Turkey to change the Middle East according to their own needs at present, we are seeing that these laws do not offer hope whatsoever. But what is really important is that, of course, that there is pressure mounted, you know, by lawyers, NGOs, and the society to these institutions and organs of not only the Council of Europe, but all over Europe, in order to make sure that even these limited legal framework can also actually work for Abdullah Öcalan as well. So
maybe you could speak also about the recent visit of the CPT, the Committee to Prevent Torture, in that light. Why was that important? Did we learn anything new? Did it change anything? What are the next steps?
Mm-hmm. It was very strange, of course, that the CPT organized this visit, because it wasn't very long ago that CPT publicized its visits for the year. And suddenly, there was an ad hoc visit to Turkey. The focus of the visit was the situation of the refugees and those forcibly displaced and the detention centers. And as with that visit, what they did was to visit the Imralı Island prison as well. So we do not know much more than that. But I must agree with the KCK co-chair, Cemil Bayık, that it raises high suspicions as to the intent of such a visit. Because we know that Turkey was expected to deliver an answer, a response to the Committee of Ministers Human Rights meetings in relation to the aggravated life sentence and how Turkish state envisages to implement the decision of the Court of Human Rights. And as far as we know, there was no such response yet delivered by Turkey to the Committee of Ministers. And it seems, as Duran Kalkan mentions, that this is to gap that, you know, fill that gap of that response not being delivered, and to appease and to silence the slowly building up of noise coming from all four corners of the world, including the Kurdish community. And obviously, it's nothing satisfactory, because we know that this report being made public can take forever. You know, it takes forever to actually write the report, and then it takes forever to actually get Turkey to agree to publish this report, because it's subject to the state's agreement before this can be published. So therefore, you know, it's been 24th year that the 9th of October forcing out of Öcalan, but it's entering next year, 24th year, that Öcalan is on the Imralı Island prison. And truthfully, nobody has time for such cat and mouse games, you know. Öcalan is 73 years of age. He's been on an island prison for 23 years. And obviously his ideas are shattering through not only thick walls, but vast distances, despite his severe isolation and being cut off from the whole world.
Yes, and maybe now then it would then be an appropriate time to speak about perhaps the latest instance of that in Iran. Kind of as you said, there's a similarity, I think, in that Öcalan's ideas, you know, didn't just spring out of nowhere in 1999, but took a long time to develop, and developed in conversation also with the Kurdish women's movement. And similarly, these protests in Iran, although they have their clear short-term cause, also have kind of very deep roots. And I wonder if you could speak a bit about the relationship of Öcalan's ideas and the ideas of the Kurdish movement and what's happening now on the streets of Iran.
Matt, if you allow me, I might come back to that question, because while we are at the aggravated life imprisonment sentence, mm-hmm. I might want to say a few things about that, because that's very much on the agenda. And you've already asked the question whether, you know, there's an expectancy that he will be legally freed. I think what we need to understand, that although the death penalty was officially abolished in Turkey, what happened is that by retroactively adopting an aggravated life imprisonment for Öcalan, that what the Turkish state did was to discriminate and create an exception for Abdullah Öcalan. And they convinced Europe by claiming that this was an harmonization law in its accession attempt to the European Union back in 2005. And this was very clearly called Öcalan laws at the time in the parliament in Turkey. Now, what we're seeing, in fact, that he's experiencing the execution of this death penalty spread over time, you know. And I think this is something that we really should not be fooled about. So at the time when the death penalty was officially abolished, there was only life sentence in place in Turkey. An aggravated life sentence means there is no parole whatsoever. So therefore, this is a death penalty spread over time. Now, but the problem now lies in the fact that you cannot have a law placed, you know, discriminately against one person, because now it is applied to thousands of people, and still the lawyers cannot learn from the Ministry of Justice how many thousands of people have now this sentence of aggravated life imprisonment. So let's talk about this aggravated life imprisonment a little bit. We are seeing that this is not something new. It is a tool to undermine civil liberties, and this has been used in the past very much. We know from Montesquieu that there is a direct correlation between length of imprisonment and the more or less a so-called libertarian character of the state. And the fact that Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg has kind of accepted this aggravated life imprisonment and shows Turkey a way out of this by asking it to put in place a mechanism to overview whether there's a need for parole or not. It falls into the same dictatorial outlook. And the reason for that is that this was something that comes from even the past of Europe, actually. You know, characterization of political opponents as enemies of the people and their imprisonment is not something new. There are two good examples of this. One was introduced into German law by the Nazi regime. It was called security detention. And, you know, they operated this, those who opposed the Nazi regime and did not fit its model of a good citizen. And the other is the very known example of Nelson Mandela, who was convicted in 1962. Something as a similar sentence to Abdullah Öcalan. Now, but the damaging consequences of this repressive policy must be understood beyond the individual Öcalan, but including Öcalan. So this erasure of political opponents that is being started to be used by Öcalan is spreading beyond the borders of Turkey, spilling over into Europe and perhaps beyond, because we know of such cases in the UK as well. So therefore, you know, we must understand how this trend is rising to be able to understand, you know, the direction that we must take, that while at the same time to put pressure on these institutions to make a positive interpretation of law in the interests of the oppressed and not the political power behind them, you know, which certainly the Committee of Ministers is the worst case scenario, because it's one of the places where high profits and interests talk and not human rights, unfortunately. But nevertheless, you know, the pressure must be kept on them. But most importantly, of course, the struggle of women, the peoples, must go on to be able to overcome the way these laws are used against them.
Absolutely. I think we could go on for a long time. I think that's it's a good note to end on, and to be reminded, of course, of all the forces that are opposing this movement and its representative, but also therefore that in itself kind of illustrates, you know, the importance of continued, as you say, struggle in this cause through various means, not only legally but also through the struggle of the people in all its forms. Haveen, thank you very much for joining us today. We really do appreciate your time. If you would like to share, please go ahead.
Yes. Just, you know, with your last question on Iran and East Kurdistan. Now, of course, you know, I think, as I said, despite the severe isolation of Öcalan and totally being cut out of connection with the world, his ideas are spilling over to all around the world. And this includes East Kurdistan, Rojhelat, and Iran in general. As I said, despite the attempt to hijack, you know, any kind of struggle, especially the one in Iran, I think we should be very clear on that the message that Öcalan is giving is clearly reaching the people, both women, but also the men and society at the same time. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the connection between women, life, and freedom. You know, much has been said, especially, you know, in connection to the connection etymologically between jinn and jinn, but also the word azadi, especially in Sumerian, which means amargi, or going back to the womb of the mother, you know. So Öcalan establishes all this connection to describe the set of values that a woman-led system embodied in the past, and he's looking at how to revitalize that and how to reclaim and rebuild it with especially the lead of the woman and her participation and her reclaiming. I just want to finish up by saying that women and the society is really able to connect with what this slogan embodies. And Öcalan, and I cannot say enough that people should really go back and read Öcalan's writings. There, he is trying to establish a dialogue with everybody, and including men, because Öcalan is seeing that women are more than ready to overcome the situation that they are in, but it is the men who is being, you know, who is not transforming. So therefore, with this connection, he's also showing the men and the society that this is the true path to freedom. And thus, despite the oppression and attacks, Kurdish Renaissance cannot be stopped, nor can the freedom for Öcalan.